D-Mace, Vingen, and Donick, 102.5. The Game, Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingen, and David Janes here with you. The Tennessee Titans are still seeking a head coach. Applicants need not apply. They'll call you. Don't call them. But John Harbaugh is still out there, and there were reports over the weekend connecting Harbaugh to the Titans in some form or fashion. For example, Diana Russini of The Athletic posted on Saturday, quote, John Harbaugh is spending today and the next few days watching film specifically on quarterbacks Jackson Dart and Cam Ward. He's also been in contact with team decision makers while continuing to communicate with potential members of his own coaching staff. Albert Breer of the Sports Illustrated, said that the quote-unquote realistic landing spots, this was Saturday, as of now, were the Giants, Dolphins, Titans, and Falcons. We had one texter just say, are these reports true? One texter responded and said, Harbaugh just said that to be polite. And maybe that's true. We've all been there, right? We've all said things we didn't really mean just so that we could be polite.
But this is why I think the process is important. The day-to-day, what's your attack when you wake up in the morning on the search, right? Somebody on your committee, right? And Mike Borgonzi did say there is a committee, right? Yes. He mentioned four guys. Somebody has got to be on, all right, let's see if, can we really gauge before we sit back and wait for the phone call, like how do we gauge the real interest level of Harbaugh to where we say this is where we need to set our sights. We have a realistic shot as opposed to how many other people are they going to interview? There's a bunch that they already have, and then there's another list, a very long list of people they intend to interview.
Would they interview how many already? Four?
They've confirmed seven interviews so far.
Man, that's a lot. I mean, listen, with this organization, they feel they have to explore every option. You know, I don't see why they shouldn't continue to, you know, see what John is thinking. And, you know, I would try to make a run for him just like any other team out there. I wouldn't think, you know, we have no shot at him. So we're not going to really, you know, play in that pool. No, I think they should pull out all the stops. If this is the guy they want and the guy they feel that's going to change their franchise or help change their franchise, then pull out every stop you need to pull out, because you got to get it right this time. Every time you should, but this time you really got to get it right.
So I want to ask you two a question that Mike Sando posed in his weekly column on The Athletic. John Harbaugh looks like the hottest candidate in 2025. Should he be in the 2025 coaching cycle, I should say? Should he be? Mike Sando writes, quote, when the Ravens fired Harbaugh after 18 seasons, 12 playoff appearances, and one championship, the 63-year-old coach instantly became the most qualified candidate in the market. His resume speaks for itself, but how much of Harbaugh's success with the Ravens is exportable? Where's the bell? I'm going to give Mike Sando a bell for exportable. Hold on. Derek, your bag of salad is in the way.
I'm sorry.
There.
Bag of salad.
From an executive from another team, quote, Harbaugh gives you a system and a leader. If you are an organization that is rudderless, he gives you that direction. He automatically establishes a standard and a belief. But you could say that about Pete Carroll as well, and that has not changed with him. But organizational dysfunction is dysfunction.
Yeah, it is. Okay. We rank these head coaches by what? What have they done in this league? And it's no different than any other sport when they fire a head coach. It's, you know, what's your resume look like? How did you put together a team? You know, what did you do with that team? So that is going to, you know, and some people – you know, may not care that John Harbaugh has won a Super Bowl and has had one of the best, you know, runs of any head coach out there. when you're just talking about wins. I'm not talking about Super Bowls when you're talking about wins. And some people may look at that as, you know what, yeah, he did that back in the day, or he did that some years ago. Is he still that same coach? Well, I would tend to think, because he's, again, I go back to, he's sort of reinvented himself sort of every 8 years, it seemed. The 8 years, 8, 9 years, or whatever. He's reinvented himself from Joe Flacco to Lamar Jackson. Nothing tells me that he can't reinvent himself again to coach another team to a championship. Some people think it's probably over. You know, he had his best chance in Baltimore. But then again, I think his method of doing things, I think it travels.
Okay.
I think people were kind of looking at it like, look at what happened to Bill Belichick. Mm-hmm. Like, he spent all that time in New England, and then once Tom left and it went bad, nobody, like, he was done. He couldn't coach. That's not John Harbaugh.
Now, you have to admit, though, it's theory because it hasn't been tested anywhere else besides Baltimore. But I would agree. I the thing that he's got going for him, I think, and I don't think anybody can do it alone. That's another thing that we have learned over the years, that in Baltimore for 18 years, he had really good consistency. That was the gist of the Albert Breer clip that we played earlier, mm-hmm. that the continuity, the environment that's created, mm-hmm. helps the coach be able to have the consistent product year in and year out. So he's going to have to recreate that mm-hmm. with a different group around him. So I think he certainly knows how to create his groove and what the culture should look like, but he is going to need some help, and it's new.
Yeah, he's going to need some help. I'm wondering this. Is it more so, you know, does this team fit me? I know it, yeah, obviously, but I think people are looking at it from Titans end. Well, does he fit with the Titans? Can they pay him the money? But in his mind, do the Titans fit what I see or what I envision moving forward? You know, is management running the way that I saw ran in Baltimore, where we had the success that we had? Is that sort of the same template or formula that they're using here? Because I know that formula is tried and tested and it's true, because it went through two iterations of head coaches and GMs. And that same template has worked. They won a Super Bowl with Billick and Ozzie, and then they won a Super Bowl with John and Ozzie, or John and DaCosta.
Well, here's an interesting note from Mike Sando in this column. There is no precedent for head coaches succeeding or failing after leaving the Ravens, because his only two predecessors never coached again.
Yeah.
Brian Billick never coached again, and help me pronounce this last name, Ted
Marchibroda.
Marchibroda. Neither of them coached after. Yeah.
Ted Marchibroda was at the end of the rope. He had coached for a long time in some different places. So yeah, that's interesting. It's very Steeler-like, right?
So you believe, Derek, that John Harbaugh's way of doing things can work outside of Baltimore?
I think it can. I think with Billick, it was a little bit different. I just think Billick was, however, I think it wore on people, in a sense. I don't feel that way about John. And I think the offense that Billick was trying to run, would he have been able to reinvent himself if he would have came back to coaching? Possibly, but he never, or no one chose to hire him, or he just never put his name back in the pool of head coaches potential to be hired by a team. But what I do know is that even though John hasn't been anywhere but Baltimore as a head coach, now he was in Philly as a coordinator with special teams, the same thing that I've seen from Nick Saban, same thing I've seen from John, these things, or Jeff, the way they coach and the culture that they build, it travels, you know? And I think whatever the things that John was doing in Baltimore with the help of the GM and whatnot, I think he's able to take that, reinvent it a little bit, but still have the same template, but reinvent himself as a coach with that same template.
Here's more from Mike Sando. Quote, what gives Harbaugh an edge? He's known as an excellent coach of fundamentals and someone capable of putting together a strong staff. His brother Jim is strong in those areas as well, and he's won everywhere he has coached. But as a former quarterback, Jim adds another dimension. Perhaps no one is better at instilling confidence in players of all experience levels at that position. Here's a quote from another executive, which I really enjoyed. Quote, the Giants or Tennessee would probably be the best spots for John. If I'm the Giants, I need somebody to be an adult. Even if a younger coach is the right guy, I don't know if they can afford it right now. They need a steady the ship guy, someone who can say, I don't give a bleep what has happened in the last 20 years. This is what we are about. Tom Coughlin was that. But you can take the Giants and put the Titans in there as well. The Titans probably need somebody to be an adult, a steady the ship guy, someone who can say, I don't give a bleep what has happened over the past few years.
I think that can be an important thing because it's human. I think it's easy for people to say, well, obviously you want to turn the page from what has been an environment that has got, but not everybody can do it. And think about the chore that Clark Lee did, for example, for Vanderbilt football, because he has worked a long time. It took years to, and it's still not permanent, right? They have to keep doing it to put it more and more in the rear view. But the image of Vanderbilt football, the image of Indiana football was so entrenched in, well, these guys never do any well. You know, they've never had any success. To be able to truly have your team walk into the building every day and not think about that takes time. And I think it would probably take less time in a pro environment, but it's not nothing. Right?
No, it's not nothing. I think John did the same thing when he got to Baltimore. There are things he had to establish and a culture that he had to sort of re-energize. I'm not going to say build. He had to re-energize and immerse himself and sort of fix the cracks or the leaks wherever they were. And he was able to do that. And then he was able to build onto it. Again, he comes here. I think he does the exact same thing. He builds the culture along with Brinkert and Borgonzi. More importantly, Borgonzi. But he's working from a different template than he did in when he came to Baltimore. I think we were at that time. We had a veteran team.
Yeah. It wasn't a rebuild.
Exactly. It wasn't a rebuild. He had to, you know, he had to be a head coach of a team with the rookie quarterback. But we had enough guys in the locker room that all bought in, veteran guys that all bought in, that the transition was not as bad. Because sometimes you have a new coach come in and it just doesn't go well. Guys don't buy in, whatnot. But we bought in. I think in this situation, it's different. You have really one leader. Not to say you can't potentially have more, but at this point there's one leader and that's Jeff. So now you got to build a house with one leader.
Yeah, not a huge foundation.
Exactly, not a huge foundation. So to me, if he really wants to like set that foundation and get it to where he wants it, he comes here because he can get it exactly how he wants it. With the help of Borgonzi. I think every other place, you had to deal with things. And he may take the other jobs. But there are things you got to deal with. And they're in different. Right now, it's almost like you got a clean slate.
Jake from Nashville on our text line says, with all the interviews the Titans are conducting, what are the chances that the narrative of the Titans being super picky to ensure they get the right coach is actually more that the candidates are saying no because they don't want to work for the organization?
I think that's overthinking it. I mean, let's just you have to let the process play out. I'm trying not to overanalyze the fact that they're interviewing a lot of people, right? I think that's just how they're trying to go. I don't know if it's I would be reading into it too much, in my opinion, if I were thinking, well, it's because they're worried a lot of people are going to say no. I think it's one of 32 jobs of its kind in the world. And so I think you're going to get – you have to find the right candidate for you because there will be good candidates that want that job.
The only person that, in a sense, can pick where he wants to go is John Harbaugh. Those other coaches can't do it. Not even Mike McCarthy, I think. They can't pass up a job and say, oh, I'll get one next year. No, you ain't in the same stratosphere as John Harbaugh. And I know Mike McCarthy has won a Super Bowl. But people don't look at Mike McCarthy in the same sort of light as they look at John Harbaugh, even though they both have won a Super Bowl. So all the rest of these coaches outside of John, maybe throw another coach in there. I don't know. He's the only guy that can call his shot, in a sense. The other guys, no, they can't. Now, they may end up taking a job that they wanted. But it's not like John. Like, John could just sit back and just like, okay, which one? I got to pick out a litter. I can go to any team right now and they can say yes. I don't think the other coaches are like that.
One texter says, I think John Harbaugh and Mike McCarthy are the top two candidates. Amy has too much on the line to risk going for anything other than a proven head coach. And there are a lot of available coaches who have done the job of head coach before. And there are exciting potential first-time head coaches. Jesse Minter, Clint Kubiak, Jeff Hafley, although I think the Packers' demise against the Browns may not reflect well on the Packers' defensive coordinator, Jeff Hafley, but we'll see. I just think there are too many coaches who have experience that it makes me feel like the Titans' next coach is going to be someone with experience, which I think we all, when we first started this exercise, I think we all wanted somebody who had previously done the job, correct?
Yeah. I think it'd be hard to sell the fans on somebody that hasn't had that experience. Now, they may end up picking someone that, you know, it'd be their first time, you know, first time head coach situation. But I'm not sure how well that will go over to the fan base, because if it doesn't work, like if they get somebody that's a little bit more seasoned, say Harbaugh, and say they win six games next year or whatever, and they still don't go to the playoffs, I think people will feel better if it's John Harbaugh moving forward. But if they win three, four, five games with somebody else, the fan base is going to be upset. You had a chance to go get John Harbaugh and you didn't do it. Not looking at the team developing. They're just looking at wins and losses. So
615-737-1025. Our phone and text lines are driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. We'll take your thoughts on John Harbaugh and the Titans coaching search, which continues. But coming up next, let's have a chat about something that has gone viral during NFL Wild Card Weekend. I have seen so many differing opinions on this subject, and it may not seem important, and honestly, it really isn't, but I do want to discuss it because it's been making the rounds all weekend long. 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vinge, 1025 The Game.
I want to tell you congratulations on your success, young man.
Thank you.
Hold your head up, all right? You guys have had a most magnificent season.
Thank you.
And you did a great job out there today.
Appreciate
so you
it.
Just hold your head up, okay?
Thank
and
you,
ladies
ma'am.
And gentlemen, Duval, you the one, all
Thank
right?
You, ma'am.
You keep it going. We got another season, okay?
I appreciate
Take
it.
Take care and much continued success to you and the entire team.
Thank you, ma'am.
All righty. That was Lynn Jones Turpin of the Jacksonville, Florida Free Press at the post-game news conference after the Jags lost to the Bills yesterday. And man, oh man, did that piss off journalism Twitter. It was everywhere.
Is there a thing?
Yes.
Journalism Twitter.
Journalism Twitter.
Is there a hashtag with that? Or is that just a general thing?
Hashtag Big J Journos? I don't know. I'm coming up with one off the top of my head. Joe Rex wrote Spears Journalism Twitter, as far as I'm concerned. But there was so many differing opinions on this. And my opinion on it was that it was incredibly cringeworthy. Now, it was a beautiful sentiment by Miss Lynn Jones Turpin. I feel like I could use a pep talk like that every day. Duval, you the one. Just every day. Look at myself in the mirror. You the one.
The affirmation.
Yes,
right?
I need that affirmation. But
and you, it's the first time I think I've ever heard that in that setting, right?
Yeah.
That's what made it strange. And that's why everybody is weighing in on it. Because I think probably, first of all, you go back about 30 years, maybe a little bit more than 30, the footage of a press conference was not as readily available as it is today, where every press conference is up in its entirety forever, right? You could probably find just about any press conference you want after any random game. So the exposure that you have now is different, but also journalism is different, right?
It is. And as someone who went to journalism school and always wanted to be a journalist, studied to be a journalist, when I heard that, so I first saw it because Adam Schefter reposted it and said, an awesome exchange between Liam Cohen and the reporter. And I was like, is it going to be insightful? Is it going to be combative? And then I heard that.
I thought the same thing. And the fact that he put it out there was significant in this whole thing because Adam Schefter is who he is.
And I've like, you know, Pat McAfee posted a screed on social media. It was too long to read, but it was basically like, those journalists, they're getting buried for being curmudgeons. Our show, we've got zero journalists on our show. You don't have to act like this. And I get that. Ben Baby, and yes, his actual name is Ben Baby. Ben Baby, who is the ESPN NFL Nation Bengals reporter. He is the Bengals version of Teron Davenport. He posted about this yesterday, and I think he nailed it. And these are my thoughts as well. We've reached the point where media should not discuss media ethics publicly. Even if the overwhelming majority of media members agree, the public will not get the media's viewpoint. Along those same lines, there's not enough people who currently work in media who hold traditional ethics. Too many people cheer for the team they cover or are happy to carry water, so it's a losing battle on multiple fronts. That I agree with his sentiment there. Because we journalists, we like to do a lot of navel gazing. Are you familiar with this term, navel gazing?
I think
it doesn't sound good.
Excessive self-focused introspection, often with a negative connotation of useless self-absorption. So journalists, by and large, think that they are the most important thing in the world.
Right. Well, you're holding the line for what you've been taught, right? And there's probably a lot of noble substance to that, right? Because you went to school for it.
Yes.
You've been taught how it's supposed to be done. And it does get challenged with the way things are just, not just with sports journalism, but all journalism, getting blurred with how everything gets put out there to how we absorb it.
And if Lynn Jones Turpin, if she wanted to pull Liam Cohen aside after the news conference out in the hallway and say exactly what she said, I mean, do you? That's fine. But to do it in the news conference, again, it made me cringe. And I do say this as respectfully as I can. And it's not meant to be insulting to our listeners or anybody who consumes sports journalism or journalism in general. I think there is a fundamental misunderstanding of what a journalist's job entails. We'll keep it specifically to sports journalism. People would ask me all the time, do you root for the Nashville Predators? The answer was no. I do not root for the Nashville Predators. I root for the story. So if the story that I want to write is best served by the Predators winning a game, I would root for that outcome. If my story was best served by the Predators losing or a certain player scoring, I would pull for that outcome in my own head because it's going to make a better story if this is the outcome.
But is that something you were taught, or is that how
that's
you evolved?
Me personally.
That's you personally.
That's
okay.
Me personally.
So that's not journalism school necessarily.
No, but I never rooted for the Nashville Predators.
In journalism school,
yes,
that part of it right there. Do they try to teach you that? that you have to maintain objectivity.
Yes.
That you shouldn't root for the team that you cover.
Yes. But objectivity is,
because you took it one step further when you said, I'm rooting for the story. Yes. I think that's a different thing than what you are taught in, as a journalist, to maintain the even keel.
Yes. Objectivity, of course, is a big part of journalism in general. And I get it. When you're around a team every day, when you report on a team every day, you get to know the players, the coaches, the general manager. You develop relationships. You want what's best for them, ultimately, because you get to know them on a personal level. But you do have to separate that from doing your job. Again, another personal example. I enjoyed working with David Poile for as long as I did. And David Poile and I had a good relationship, but sometimes it was contentious because David did not like the things I wrote or the things I asked him, and it was part of the deal. It wasn't personal, but it had to be a little adversarial sometimes. And I think what you saw yesterday was the extreme. An independent reporter should not be consoling a coach at the end of a playoff game. That should not happen. But as many people have noticed and many people have noted, the world of journalism is so much different now.
Right. So let's I'm going to ask you a question, Derek. When let's take what McAfee said, right? His thing is everybody's got teams that they root for, right? So he is from a different school. He is not from the school of journalism, to say the least, but he is obviously a guy that has a lot of influence. Do you think anybody, Derek, truly is unbiased? I would argue that everybody's got biases somewhere that they have to try and navigate through, no matter what they're covering.
Yeah, you have a bias toward whether it be the story, like you, Adam, whether it be the team, you know, the head coach, a player, you know, it don't matter. When you're writing a story, you have to try, whatever those biases are, you have to try as best you can is to put those biases to the side. I think people are scared to say that they have biases or say that they root for the team that they're covering. And I'm not saying that's you, Adam, but, like, it's okay. The landscape of sports has changed. The landscape of journalism has changed across the board. Sports, whatever, it's changed. It's not our Walter Cronkites or these people that's really doing, you know, in it, the trenches and everything else. I respect that type of journalism. I didn't want to be a journalist in school. Didn't even think about it. I wanted to be a communications major, and I was that. But I think in this situation, and this is just how I feel, because there's so much tearing down of a coach, and we all do it. We all, you know, criticize coaches and players alike. It don't matter. Some go further than others. But we do it, and we have to do it. Some know how to do it in an elegant way. Some just don't. I think what this lady did, young lady, older lady, I think what she did was okay. I truly believe in a world full of all this other crap that we talk about and people getting on people and people wanting you to misstep at every turn. Just because you felt it wasn't the right place, don't mean it wasn't the right place. Get out of your feelings. Get out of it. Who cares what you feel? Oh, it wasn't the right place. Damn it. Then what is the right place? The right place is when I say it's the right place.
Not in a news conference.
It doesn't
setting.
Matter. It doesn't. To y'all or to somebody else. And I'm not saying that y'all are wrong. I'm not. Y'all would have been wonderful with that lady going off on Liam Cohen, his team. Y'all had a terrific season. Y'all ended up blowing it in the playoffs, yada, yada. Y'all would have loved that.
I would.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. Look at her go at Liam Cohen.
So you're saying an extreme in exactly. The other way is accepted.
It's accepted.
An extreme this way
when you,
is not.
And then when a lady comes, it could have been a man.
Now
I don't care who it could have been.
That's a fair question to you, Adam, as the guardian of the journalist. Sometimes the baited questions that Derek, as a former athlete, is sensitive to. I get sensitive to sometimes the trap question where you're playing gotcha with the coach. That is not accepted by everybody, but it is accepted. I'm asking the tough question. So that is the other extreme. So that I think that's a fair comeback. Not that I would say that this one does this move the needle positively or negatively in the world? No. It's an interesting example. I would think that every journalism class is probably having this discussion, hopefully having it maturely, and saying, look, would you do it again? And I feel like I didn't get a chance to hear her. She's spoken about it, and I didn't get a chance to hear what she said. I'm curious whether she would, if the same thing happens next
would
year,
she do it again?
Would she say the same thing? Because, look, she said it. It's going to be, but how do you feel about the other thing? Do journalists come down hard on somebody who's clearly trying to bait a coach or a player?
It's a good question. I do think people are more accepting of the opposite, which is the tough, combative...
Gotcha.
Not always gotcha questions. I understand that point. Not always gotcha questions. I mean, I'll give you another personal example. Mm-hmm. We have Barry Trotz on the show every week. We'll have Barry Trotz on tomorrow. We haven't seen Barry live and in living color in a few weeks. We will see him tomorrow at Bridgestone Arena at 5 o'clock. When things weren't going well, I did feel a certain responsibility to ask tough questions to Barry Trotz. I don't think I asked gotcha questions to Barry Trotz, but I don't think I would have been doing my job and serving all of you if I weren't asking tough questions about Andrew Burnett and the state of the team and players being traded and all of those sorts of things. But I try to be as fair as I can. But what the woman said, it was a really nice sentiment. As you said, Derek, we need more of that in life. We need people who lift us up versus tear us down. Just don't do it at a news conference. You can follow Liam Cohen out of the room, pull him aside, and say literally the exact same thing. I just think that for as often as people pile on journalists for the pointed questions they ask, people are going to see this clip and be like, man, those journalists, they're soft, man. They're soft.
I think it should just be this is what this particular journalist decided to say in the moment. I don't know if that's ever been done. I don't know if anybody else will do it. I don't think this is going to start
a
trend.
I think people have, not to that extreme, but I think people have done it. They have complimented the coach in press conference.
I think the way to do it, you tell me, Adam, if this would be out of line, to say, hey, Coach, before I ask this question, I just want to say thanks for your professionalism and congratulations on a good season. Now, here's my question. Mm-hmm. And not just, did she ask a question? I can't pretend I wasn't there for the whole press conference.
I don't know if she actually asked a question. I assume she did because she was speaking at the news conference, but the only part that went viral is the part that we played.
But I think
make it a little quicker, you know?
I think she elaborated on it and explained, you know, what she was thanking him for and who his team was and who she felt his team was or felt his team is. I think to people that, you don't say that. But we've heard plenty of times at the beginning of a press conference or an interview where you congratulate the coach or you congratulate the player. Great win. You've done a great job. Good job, coach. With your team this year.
But I'm also one of those.
Congratulations on a win. Aren't you still speaking highly on this person? I know it wasn't like what she said, but we can't. Why do we get to pick and choose?
Well, let me give you
what
an example.
Is said, especially in a form like that's not a form where it's written on the wall. Do not praise the head coach or any other coach when you walk in this room.
Let me give you an example. Willie, Steven Stamkos scored his 600th goal in Utah, correct?
Correct.
If I had been covering that game on the road and I approached Steven Stamkos
at his locker at the end of the game.
Yeah, not on camera necessarily.
But in the
locker room.
We're walking. Everybody's walking towards Steven Stamkos because he's going to address reporters. If I were asking the first question, I may say, "Steven, congratulations on 600 goals." Here's my question.
600 was in Vegas.
Or Vegas. 600 goals. My question. I think a little acknowledgement is fine.
Sure.
But I wouldn't have gone overboard.
Now, if she would have asked him, because I don't know if she, it doesn't seem like she asked him a question after that.
We'll have to listen.
Or did she ask him a question before she said all that? The second question was, whatever. I don't know exactly, but I don't need to know because in my mind, again, I'm not a journalist. So if y'all listening to this, journalists out there, and say, oh, that's because you're not a journalist. You damn right I'm not a journalist. I don't want to do your job. Your job is hard. A lot of time. I get it. I understand it. I respect it. So I'm not a journalist. But I am a human. And humanity is needed right about now in every realm. That's what I am. So if you want to drop a nice nugget on somebody, some words of encouragement, isn't that what we want all the time? Words of encouragement, affirmation? If you want to drop it on the coach, then okay, let him receive it the way he's going to receive it. We can't sit here just because we don't like it. So what?
I do like that she was seeing the coach as a human. Sometimes I think what bugs me is it becomes dehumanized.
Mm-hmm.
And a journalist is only like, or no, I shouldn't say a journalist. Sports media sometimes they can detach themselves and treat the person as if he or she is not a person like you that mm-hmm. goes home to a family that is completely oblivious to mm-hmm. the reaction and the pressure and things like that. I do like acknowledgement that there's a human connection between media and coach and vice versa mm-hmm. too.
Let's quickly go to Tim on our phone line. Tim, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Derek, I agree 100% with what you said. But the other thing is, you remember the song back in the 80s or 90s, Dirty Laundry?
Yes, Don Henley.
That's what everybody wants to hear. They don't care about the good stuff. They want to hear the dirty laundry. That's why journalists do what they do. That sells papers. That sells ads.
Thank you for the call, Tim. He
said ads.
Ads.
Yes.
Yes. 615-737.
ADS.
Yes.
ADS.
615-737-1025. We've got some reaction. We'll take it. And we'll wrap up the show. Coming up next, Willie Dunnick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025 The Game. D-Mace, Vingan, and Dunnick, 1025 The Game. Thank you for allowing me to take us to journalism ethics class. By the way, Tim said selling ads with a D. Selling ads. Not selling something else.
Yes.
But he said selling ads. I want people to buy newspapers. Support support journalism. Support journalism.
Newspapers, man? Seriously?
Yes. What about them?
I mean, isn't newspapers, it's about...
It's hard to find a newspaper.
Yeah, it is. Very hard.
Sad story over the last week or so. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, another
completely
staple.
Completely folding. Terrible news.
Newspaper.
Yeah. Terrible news. Support journalism.
Right. So I do think in this discussion, we should say journalism is extremely important.
Yes.
Extremely important.
You know what else is extremely important? The Vanderbilt basketball teams.
Undefeated still.
The Commodores.
Men and women.
The Commodore Hour is coming up next, by the way. Mm. The men and women are off to, excuse me. They've both matched the best starts in program history. The men are 16-0. The women are 17-0. So if they remain undefeated following their next games, that will be the best start in school history. Combined.
Did I get my math right?
Yes.
My math right?
That is correct. 33-0. By the way, the Vanderbilt men are now number 10 in the country. They have not been in the top 10 since the 2011-12 preseason poll. So it's been that long since the men were ranked in the top 10. They are back in action on the road at Texas on Wednesday.
Not an easy game, by the way. Texas had a good win the other day. They beat Alabama.
Oh. Well, there you go.
They beat Alabama. And it was at Alabama.
I did see part of that game, actually.
So I wonder if Nate Oates also considers Texas a really good team.
He may have to now. By the way, there is one fewer undefeated team in men's basketball. Michigan lost on Saturday to Wisconsin.
That was, yes.
So there are,
it was at Michigan, too.
At Michigan.
Good so there, win for Wisconsin.
There
wow.
are on, there are only five undefeated teams in the country for the men. Listen to this list. Arizona, Iowa State, Vanderbilt, Nebraska, and Miami, Ohio.
Can we do a like a preemptive take it to the bank and see which one of these teams lose first?
That's
which
a good
one
question.
Will lose first?
Yeah, who loses first?
I'd have to look at all five's next opponent.
Don't Texas sleep on the Red Hawks. Don't Texas sleep on those Red Hawks.
It's not easy. Mm-hmm. Sean Miller coaching Texas now, by the way. It's a different look, right?
Yes.
Sean Miller's been some different places. I felt for you. Speaking of take it to the bank, D-Mace, you went all in on Vanderbilt thrashing LSU, and for 20 minutes,
they
put on a clinic in the first half. They couldn't miss. They scored 52 in the first half.
Mm-hmm. Rain and threes everywhere.
And then it went completely the other way in the second half. They only hit 1-3, and it got a little too – it got down to 6 or 5 at one point. You know, they were up by over 20 at one point. So they kind of sleptwalk through the second half. And you didn't get any points.
Yeah,
from that.
I was kind of.
I was hoping
I got
get
mine
the
for Tyler Tanner though.
I was kind of bummed, but they did exactly what I feared because they've done it before, and hopefully you know it may help them you know as they get further along playing these tough games when it comes down to the last couple of possessions. But if they don't get it right, they're going to end up losing games, not because they're not the better team, but because they didn't play full 48 minutes of basketball. Like, they have these spells at the end of the half or the end of the games where they're up, and all of a sudden it's just like they lose focus. And whether it's turnovers, it was some bad shots this past weekend.
Yeah, that's
some bad ones.
They rushed some things and it allowed LSU to get back in it. The other thing that Vanderbilt has got to make sure they're on top of, especially when they're still down a main guy in the rotation in Frankie Collins, they've got to manage their fouls. They are fouling a lot. In fact, I'm looking at the KenPom here.
The LSU and the Alabama game, they got in foul trouble.
And it was a problem last year as well. They're pretty aggressive on the perimeter, and it does lead to turnovers. Their defense overall has a really good rating, number 11 in the ranking. I'm trying to look at where I can find the fouls, but they foul too much. That is something they've got to try to take down just a little bit. You don't want to lose your identity, but if you're constantly having games where going down the stretch, you're a little undersized, and your big guy like Okereke and McLaughlin. If they got four fouls with 8 minutes to go, or Duke Miles can get himself in foul trouble some, that's not what you want, right? You want to be able to play without fearing of fouling out down the stretch.
I do also want to give a shout-out to the women because they are one of three remaining undefeated teams in the country, Texas Tech, UConn, and Vanderbilt. So the Vanderbilt basketball programs, the only program in the country with undefeated men's and women's basketball teams.
Just let the let them play each other. Then, you know, somebody.
Michaela Blake's
could
put up some points now.
Oh, damn straight she can.
They're looking good. Mm-hmm. Vanderbilt's men at Texas Wednesday. Florida, defending champion, coming in on Saturday.
Just crushed Tennessee, by the way.
Florida's starting to, you know, they're gonna be
Boogie
really good.
Fland had a good game like the other day.
That will be a huge game on Saturday. And then after that, they go to Arkansas. So,
ooh.
Trying to stay undefeated is not an easy job. These next three will be very, very challenging.
So are you saying that I should not take the Commodores and Derek's prediction?
Look, I don't think this is going to be the 76 Indiana Hoosiers. They're not that type of team. They're going to lose some games. But I think it's staying consistent, trying to get as good a seed as you possibly can. They've got a high ceiling here, but I'm not confusing them with – you know, UNLV of the early 90s.
Iowa State goes to Kansas tomorrow.
Ooh, that's going to be a tough one.
Iowa State could
fall
there.
That'll be
there.
A game that they'll have the Lions Den going there mm-hmm. in Fog Allen.
Now, Vandy plays Florida first.
They play Texas.
They got
tomorrow.
At Texas, and then they got Florida at home. Then at Arkansas.
Ooh.
Then at Mississippi State, who's tough. Not bad either.
Man, that's a tough 3-game run right there.
It's good. I said this the other day. It's good to be a Vanderbilt fan right now, Willie. Things are going well.
I'm riding the wave.
I still think that Memphis game, I think it that game spoke a lot about who that team is, because this should have been a foul called every play down. It was aggressive. They were letting them play. It was helter skelter. It was just up and down, but they still found a way to win in sort of this chaotic way. So hopefully, you know, yeah, they're going to have some close games, but just like they did against Memphis, they're able to fight through it and win.
That'll do it for us today. We will be live at Bridgestone Arena tomorrow, where the Predators will host the Edmonton Oilers. How many goals will Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl score? We'll find out together tomorrow. Barry Trotz will join us. Trevor Maddich will join us. And you should join us, too, starting tomorrow at 3 o'clock.
Be loved, love on your people. Have a safe, blessed, and wonderful day. I love you. The team loves you. You hear that music. Don't you forget about us, because we will never forget about you. See you tomorrow, 3 p.m. from Bridgestone tomorrow. Peace.